about his position. He was at the top of the heap. There was the possibility of a multi-million-dollar award in his pending suit. But he didn't have it yet, and the Houston law firm handling the case would undoubtedly take a large chunk of any payoff. Cheryl was concerned that Brad was spending a tremendous amount of money to maintain his upscale lifestyle, more money than he even made. Eric Lindenauer could see that Cheryl was on the offensive. She was through looking the other way, and she would never make an excuse for Brad again. He, of all people, had seen Cheryl in action in the courtroom, and her offensive was tough. She confided that Brad had paid virtually nothing toward their household expenses for years. Even when he had worked for Citizens Savings as an upper echelon executive, Cheryl had paid all the bills. "Maybe he'd buy pizza once in a while," she said bitterly. Eric considered Brad a major jerk. He wasn't a nice person. He felt sorry for Cheryl, and he was amazed that a man like Brad could ever have attracted a woman like her in the first place. She was one of the most brilliant lawyers he had ever encountered. Cheryl was fearless in court. "One of the fastest people on her feet I've ever seen," Eric commented. Brad Cunningham was the only one to intimidate her. She was the easiest person to like. Besides Brad, she had no other enemies. Brad had quite clearly become an enemy, but that went both ways. Cheryl's intimate knowledge of Brad's machinations made her a threat to him. If he was only a blowhard full of sound and fury and veiled threats, Brad couldn't do physical harm to Cheryl. He had her on the ropes, but she was fighting back now, and she could be a formidable opponent. In August, when the time neared for Jess and Michael to be enrolled in school, the long, deceptively cool summer began to heat up. Brad's phone calls had a new, more menacing undertone, and Cheryl continued to write down every word, every phrase. She often showed her notes to her brother Jim. "Called my mother a lying slut on the phone when he called back. Won't give me keys to get tires myself. If not resolved, he will dispose of tires." Jim occasionally drove the van. He used her keys that she kept on a round leather key ring, car keys and house keys. She had separate office keys. Cheryl's life was a paradox that summer. One part of her lived in the world of the devoted mother and successful young attorney. There were men who found her attractive, men who called and wanted to date her. Occasionally, very occasionally, she went out, but she always seemed to be listening, always waiting for something to happen. She was never completely with anyone, because another role she had assumed was that of quarry. There was no mystery about whom she feared. It was Brad. She had come to a place where she constantly watched her back. Eric knew that there was nothing he or anyone could do legally to protect Cheryl from Brad. It's one of the necessary incongruities of the law that one cannot call the police and report a crime about to happen. If that were possible, police dispatchers could never find enough officers to respond. Most of the frightening threats made in anger or in drunkenness are never carried out. True, restraining orders can be obtained, but they're only paper. Enraged stalkers are rarely put off by the words on a legal document. Brad obviously didn't love Cheryl anymore, but he had a new woman, and Eric certainly didn't think he might physically assault Cheryl. He never had before, no matter how angry he was with her. The police would probably have dismissed such a notion, too. These were two professional people with too much to lose for them to engage in physical encounters. Eric tried to keep that thought in mind. Cheryl's sister Susan agreed. She would recall saying, "I'm not afraid of Brad, Cheryl. He's not going to hurt you. He's not that dumb." On August 13th, Cheryl enrolled Jess in Bridal Mile Grade School on the West Slope. Eric went along with her because she was afraid Brad might show up and make trouble. He didn't, and she was relieved. Brad and Cheryl divided their three sons' time as precisely as if King Solomon himself had shaved the days of the week with a fine-edged sword. He had the little boys Tuesday and Wednesday and every other weekend from precisely 7 p.m. on Friday to precisely 7 p.m. on Sunday. Neither one would permit the other to be even 5 minutes late in returning the boys from a visitation. Cheryl complained to confidants that Brad brought the boys back in faded old clothes, although they left her house in new garments. Philip's new car seat disappeared and was replaced by an old one. The most basic chores of everyday living had become a struggle. Cheryl had a brief respite when she took the boys on vacation with her. Her fear dissipated with every mile away from Portland. She spent Labor Day with her half-sisters Debbie Bowen and Kim Roberts, Floyd Keaton's daughters by his second wife, Gabriella, and their families in Vacaville, California. But she had to leave early to get back. She had to be sure that Jess had a good start at his new school. September 2nd was Jess's first day at Bridal Mile School. Eric had arranged to pick up Cheryl very early in the morning so they could drop Michael at his preschool and also avoid Brad if he came to the house. Cheryl and Eric had just arrived at Bridal Mile School with Jess when Brad suddenly appeared carrying Philip. Moments later, they were engaged in a clash of wills that appalled the principal, Peter Hamilton. Never before and never again would he see parents so out of control. "These parents hated each other," he would recall. The cause of their argument was not that unusual. Hamilton had seen any number of divorced parents who disagreed over where their children would go to school. It was the ferocious intensity of the fight between Cheryl and Brad that alarmed Hamilton. While scores of parents, first graders, and kindergartners stared, stunned, Brad was calling his wife a slut and a cunt, and he looked at her with venom and naked hatred in his eyes. Here in a sunny hallway that smelled of wax and crayons and fresh first day of school clothes, Cheryl and Brad seemed about to come to blows. Hurriedly, Hamilton ushered them into his office where they could talk without everyone in the building hearing them. Brad was enraged because he wanted Jess to go to Chapman School in downtown Portland where he lived. Further, he was furious that his name didn't even appear on the application for enrollment to Bridal Mile. Cheryl had left the square marked Father blank. For 20 minutes, Brad and Cheryl railed at each other. Even with Hamilton's attempts at mediation, nothing was settled, except they all agreed that Brad's name should be added to the Bridal Mile registration card. There was no agreement on where Jess would go to school. The excited little boy's first day of school had been ruined, and Hamilton was so shaken by the confrontation that he jotted down what had happened on a 5x7 card. He really didn't have to. He could never forget the hatred that had suffused his office with an almost palpable cloud. He wondered how those two parents could ever have gotten close enough to each other to conceive the poor little boy who shrank against the wall as they fought over him. Brad told Sarah about the scene at Bridal Mile. He reported that Cheryl had yelled and screamed at him, that she had hit him, and that, in general, she had behaved like a trampy fishwife. "My impression from Brad was that Cheryl had caused the scene," Sarah recalled. "Brad said he was holding little Philip in his arms, and Cheryl screamed and caused a really big commotion. He said she almost hit Philip while he was in Brad's arms. He was very angry and upset." After all the screaming and fighting, Jess was finally allowed to attend first grade at Bridal Mile. He went to Bridal Mile from September 2nd, 1986, until Friday, September 19th. He had 17 days of an almost normal childhood. After that, everything would change. Seeing her son in tears because his first day at school had been ruined, something in Cheryl had rebelled. She would give her little boys a normal childhood no matter what it took. She would no longer allow Brad to play his terrible games with their lives. Yes, she had agreed to shared custody, but she no longer believed that either she or the boys would survive emotionally if that continued. She now wanted full custody. She wanted Brad out of her life and out of their lives. She had been gathering evidence for months, and she was finally ready to face the thing she feared most. And that was Bradley Morris Cunningham. Chapter 29. Cheryl continued taking notes of everything her estranged husband said to her, both at home and when he called her at her office. She often read her notes aloud to Jim or handed over the tablet for him to read. Eric Lindenauer was also aware that Cheryl was documenting all of her contacts or calls with Brad. Ostensibly, she was getting ready for her day in divorce court. But literally, and almost unbelievably, she was preparing for another eventuality. If she should not be around to face Brad in court, she wanted a written record to exist of all that had taken place in the final months of her marriage. Jim didn't want to talk with Cheryl about the dread possibilities she sometimes envisioned, but he listened as she spoke softly to him. She let me know that she had changed her will so that Brad would have no control over her estate, Jim said. Cheryl was no longer fearful only of losing her sons. She was afraid that they would lose her, that something might happen to her, something so subtle that it would seem tragic, but not criminal. One night Cheryl looked hard at her brother and said, "Jim, I fear for my life. Short of my collapsing and dying in front of you, I want you to assume that any accident involved wasn't an accident. Pursue it. Pursue it." 3 times Cheryl told Jim the same thing. 3 times he told her not to be frightened. The terrible scene at Bridal Mile School had given Cheryl a glimpse into the searing rage Brad was capable of. Certainly she had seen him angry before, although he had usually shown his public face, the smooth, charming facade of a man who had his life and his emotions under perfect control. But Brad had lost it at Bridal Mile, just as he had once lost it at the boys' Montessori school. No, not just. This time Cheryl sensed that he had been ready to kill her for having the temerity to register his son in the school she had chosen. She knew it was going to get worse. She hadn't even brought out her big guns yet, her list of witnesses from Brad's past, and when she did, she could envision what Brad's reaction would be. It terrified her. She was fully prepared to do whatever was necessary to keep Jess, Michael, and Philip with her. Cheryl never wanted them to be the object of the kind of wrath that Brad was capable of, but she also knew full well that she might die trying to save them from that. After Cheryl had made up her mind to divorce Brad in February, she had returned to Portland with an iron resolve. She had also been seized with the premonition that she might have less time than she expected. She had called her friend and co-worker, Carrie Radcliffe. They had attended law school together, and they both were employed by Garvey Schubert, Carrie on the business side, and Cheryl in litigation. Carrie still worked in the Seattle branch of the firm. "She called me from Portland," Carrie later said, "in the 3rd week of February, on a Wednesday or a Thursday. Cheryl was agitated. She said, 'I'm going to ask you a huge favor. This might sound unreasonable and demanding, but I need to have this done.' She said she had gathered her strength and filed for divorce. She wanted to have her will changed that day and have me Federal Express it down to her so that it would be effective right away. She was not her normal self. She was very much upset." Carrie had drawn up both Cheryl's and Brad's wills 5 or 6 years earlier. At that time, Cheryl had expressly stipulated that all of her estate was to go to her spouse, Bradley Morris Cunningham. Now she wanted to invalidate that will immediately. She told Carrie that she feared Brad's reaction, but she wanted to be sure that, in case of her death, Nothing she owned went to Brad. Jess, Michael, and Philip should inherit whatever she had. She also told Kerry that she didn't want Brad to be named guardian of the boys. I told her that until the divorce was final, this will might not have the full legal effect, Kerry said. But Cheryl said, I want this down. I want it in my will. I told her that if Brad were still alive, the court would probably make him guardian, and she said, I know that, but I want my intent in my will. I don't want him to be guardian. Cheryl's first will had been pretty much a boilerplate will in Washington, a community property state. All property acquired after marriage becomes community property of the two spouses in equal shares. What each partner brings into the marriage is separate property, and that includes later bequests or inheritances. Cheryl was adamant that her new will override the community property statutes. She was filing for divorce in Oregon, which is not a community property state. Kerry did exactly as Cheryl asked, and she did it so hurriedly that she actually FedExed it with a few typographical errors. Cheryl's new will was blunt. It said she was married to Bradley Morris Cunningham, but was separated from him and in the process of dissolving the marriage. It stated her intention to leave all of her property to her three sons and to make no provision for Bradley Morris Cunningham. The will Kerry Radcliffe prepared was a long document. On page 9 it read, If it becomes necessary that a guardian be appointed for any of my children, I name my mother Betty Marie Vandiver. If she is unable to act in this capacity, I nominate my former stepfather, Robert McNanny. Cheryl had considered a number of people who would take good care of her children if she were no longer around to do it. She asked Sharon McCulloch if she and her husband would take them, and Sharon said, We considered it, and we would have if she'd put us in her will. But our children were so much older than Cheryl's boys. Susan McNanny and her boyfriend, Dave Keegan, were also willing to raise Jess, Michael, and Philip, even though Susan wasn't 20 yet. They agreed between them to reassure Cheryl of their commitment to her children. Cheryl had also tried to provide for the eventuality that Brad would become the guardian of their children. If she couldn't prevent that, she would stop him from spending the money she left them. She directed that any funds from her estate were to go directly to pay for their education, their medical care, et al., and that nothing should ever pass through Brad's hands first. Kerry didn't know at that point how completely Cheryl's marriage had crumbled or why. Cheryl told me that she felt very strongly that the children should not stay with Brad. She talked about his having guns and firearms around. She said something about a place in eastern Washington that had filled up with canned goods, as if he had a survivalist type of mentality. Legally, the job of a guardian is basically to act as a substitute parent and provide a home and love to a minor child. A trustee is the guardian of a minor's money. Often, of course, one person serves both functions. However, it's not unusual for a guardian and a trustee to be two separate people. A loving parental substitute may have little knowledge about money matters. Cheryl named her longtime friend John Burke as the executor of her will. He would become the personal representative of her estate and have her will probated. She also named John Burke and Bob McNanny as alternate trustees of her son's inheritance. Cheryl knew what she was doing when she picked her old friend to look after her boy's money if she should die. She told me that of all the lawyers she knew, Kerry said, she trusted John Burke to be very strong in that position. He was somebody who could stand up to Brad. She knew that a lot of pressure would be put on this person. She said, Brad is very manipulative, and he can wear people down. Above all, Cheryl didn't want Brad dipping into what belonged to the boys. She hadn't been able to put much aside, not with the expenses she had carried for so many years, but she had a retirement fund with Garvey Schubert, and she had life insurance. If she were dead, Her estate would be worth a few $100,000. Cheryl's secretary, Florence Morrell, witnessed the will that had been drawn up so rapidly. She had been Cheryl's friend as well as her legal secretary, and she had watched the steady erosion of her confidence and peace of mind about what might happen in the months ahead. Carrie Radcliffe had, too. It seemed impossible that anyone could get her down the way Brad did. Cheryl was incredibly intelligent, very organized. She was a very strong presence, Carrie would say later, fighting back tears. She just took control when she came into a room. She was a wonderful attorney and a wonderful person. Cheryl continued to perform well for Garvey Schubert, but by the late summer of 1986, almost everyone in her Portland offices and many of her co-workers in Seattle knew that she was living in a state of siege. She was embarrassed by that, ashamed that her nerves were so close to the surface and that she jumped whenever a door slammed or a phone rang. She had also been losing weight steadily until she weighed less than 100 pounds. That wasn't nearly enough for a woman almost 5 feet 6 inches tall, and she was engaged in the litigation of her life. Never had she had an opponent as dogged or as malicious. Florence Morrell tried to be a wall between Cheryl and Brad. She saw how often Cheryl was upset and distraught. She was chain-smoking, but she wasn't eating. "Brad called constantly," Florence remembered. "At Cheryl's request, I screened all his calls. I spoke to him many times. I hardly ever put him through to her. She was so upset and trying to work, she kept notes of all his phone calls." Florence saw that Cheryl was especially uptight after depositions and her visits to psychologists in the continuing struggle over the three little boys. "I was separated myself," Florence remembered. "And we talked about our mutual problems. By that time, I was definitely stronger than she was. I'd buy her flowers and give her cards." Florence had an unsettling experience in the late summer of 1986. She came into work early one morning, sometime between 7 and 7:30. The sun was shining through the east windows. I saw Brad coming out of one of our offices. No one else was there at the time. I was startled, very startled. We passed, and I said, "Hi, Brad." Brad had had the area to himself. He smiled thinly at her and walked through the glass doors, disappearing into one of the elevators. Florence didn't see the unaddressed, unsealed envelope that lay on the receptionist's desk. Later, a receptionist idly opened it to try to figure out who it belonged to. Inside, she found photographs and negatives. They were nude pictures of Cheryl, pictures she had posed for in the early days of her marriage. They weren't provocative. They were actually lovely artistic studies of a young woman with an exquisite body. But Cheryl was mortified. She knew that Brad had intended to cause her embarrassment. Worse than that, he had apparently had free rein to wander through the offices of Garvey Schubert before they were officially open for business. "When I told Cheryl, she was very upset," Florence recalled. "She said, 'Those doors, they stay locked until someone's at that front desk.'" Sharon Stewart Armstrong was a Superior Court judge in King County, Washington in 1986. She had worked with Cheryl at Garvey Schubert beginning in 1979. Sharon took over Cheryl's caseload when she was on maternity leave and during the time she was in Houston. Like everyone who worked with Cheryl, Sharon admired her tremendously. "Cheryl was an exceptionally fine lawyer, and we were very good friends," she said. "She was very, very bright. She had a fine strategic sense. She was excellent in the courtroom. She was also a mature person, able to cope with stress and strain. She was very warm and very funny. I adored her. She was a wonderful person." When Sharon Armstrong became a Superior Court judge in August 1985, her schedule was packed and she and Cheryl didn't see each other or even talk on the phone the way they often had. In 1986, Sharon knew a little bit about Cheryl's divorce, but it was August before she heard from mutual friends about the depth of her friend's ordeal. She called Cheryl immediately and was distressed to hear that the information was true. Cheryl needed friends, and Sharon offered to come and visit in Portland on the weekend of September 19th to the 21st. She would bring along another of their old friends. Cheryl was so happy to hear that and was looking forward to the September reunion. Tragedy seemed to hover over Cheryl and her friends that summer. On August 23rd, Sharon Armstrong and her husband and daughter were in a terrible automobile accident. Sharon almost lost her husband and child, and they remained hospitalized for a long time. She herself was injured, although not as critically as the rest of her family. "I couldn't go to see Cheryl," Sharon remembered. "I was still too weak and in too much pain to go to Portland. I did talk to her on Wednesday or Thursday before the weekend we planned to get together. She told me that Brad was being a beast about the divorce." Cheryl also confided that the psychologist had just recommended that Cheryl have custody of the boys and that Brad flipped out. He was going into court to ask for a second report. "After this," Sharon said, "she told me she thought he would kill her. I thought this was startling. I asked her, 'Why on earth do you think that?' She said, 'I think he will do anything to keep me from having the kids.' She said his mother and sister were very afraid of him, that they wouldn't let him know where they lived because he had assaulted them. I became concerned. We talked about how she needed to be careful. That was the last time I heard from Cheryl." Carrie Radcliffe talked to Cheryl often in August and early September, and when Carrie learned about Sharon's accident, she relayed the awful news to Cheryl. "With the Armstrongs' accident, we talked about how fragile life was. She was really looking forward to the weekend of the 20th. Now, of course, Sharon wouldn't be coming after all, but Cheryl was grateful that Sharon and her family were still alive. After that, Carrie called often to update Cheryl about Sharon's progress until Sharon herself was strong enough to call. Carrie talked to Cheryl again early in September, 2 weeks before the weekend of September 19th to the 21st. Cheryl told her about the scene at Bridal Mile when she had tried to enroll Jess. She said that Brad had screamed and yelled at her and had yanked on Jess's arm, trying to pull him away from her. Jess was embarrassed. She was embarrassed. "How are you doing?" Carrie asked. "You don't want to know," Cheryl answered, sounding so tired. "I get up each morning, gather my strength together, and I get through the day." There was little that Carrie could say. Suddenly Cheryl blurted, "Carrie, if I die, Brad did it." She asked Carrie if she could come down on the weekend of the 19th, since Sharon couldn't come. "I didn't go. I couldn't that weekend," Carrie remembered sadly. There would never be another weekend. Chapter 30. On September 16th, 1986, Cheryl and Brad met at the offices of Kell, Alterman, and Runstein in the Bank of California Tower in Portland. Reporter Michael R. King would record their depositions. Cheryl would have much preferred to give her deposition without Brad in the room, but she had no choice. Brad was deposed first. Betsy Welch was representing Cheryl, and as she attempted to get some idea of Brad's financial status, she understood what Cheryl had said about his talent for being evasive about money. He wasn't sure how long he had worked for U.S. Bank or how many hours he worked. He was beyond that. "I probably don't work. When you say work, I mean I think about my job after work. I think about my job at night sometimes. But, you know, my physical presence is not something I keep track of. I'm an exempt employee." That was true. Nobody at U.S. Bank checked on Brad. He came and went as he pleased. Brad had no idea how much money he had made in the early 1980s. "How much did you earn?" Welch asked. "I don't remember. I would have to look at our tax returns."
"Mr. Cunningham, you haven't filed a tax return since 1981, have you?"
"No. I think 82.
"I hand you your 82 return. I would like you to take a look at whatever you need to look at there and tell me what your income was for 1982.
It says here it was $5,208.
"I think if you look in the back, Mr. Cunningham, that's Cheryl's income for the year."
"Oh," Brad replied. "Well, it's a joint return."
He had no idea what his income had been. He said his accountant did his tax work.
Welch pointed out that his Schedule C profit and loss statement showed that he had had no income at all in 1982, but had claimed $159,000 of expenses. His 1981 form showed income of $1,800 in his consulting and appraisal business and claimed a $142,000 loss. Brad said his Chapter 11 bankruptcy had been filed in 1984 and mentioned his ongoing lawsuit.
"The major assets of the estate, which is this lawsuit against the contractor and his bonding company and the parent corporation, needs to be tried."
His case had been filed in Texas in the 295th District in October of 1982, but he had no idea when it was going to trial.
"When was the last time you had a trial date?"
"Gosh," Brad said, looking bemused. "I don't know. In Texas, they do things different than we do here. They don't have trial dates, you understand?"
"I don't understand."
Welch knew that Brad was intelligent, but he was acting ingenuous, as if he had no idea what was happening in his multi-million-dollar suit in Houston. He had no legal costs, he said, but Vincent and Elkins might take up to 40% of any judgment.
"What's it about?" Welch asked.
"Messed up the construction. Incredible. Violated uniform building code, uniform electrical code, plumbing code, improper construction of the concrete. I got a videotape on this stuff. It's incredible."
"What's the prayer in that case? What are you asking for in money?"
"I don't know. My attorney's prepared it. It's quite a bit of money."
"How much?"
"I don't know. 12 million. Maybe it's 14 million.
Brad, the financial wizard, the entrepreneur, suddenly didn't know what was going on. He had had no income, at least according to his IRS forms, for years, but he thought he might be suing for as much as $14 million. He agreed that he hadn't filed tax returns for 1983, 1984, or 1985, but that was not his fault. It was because his tax picture was one of the most complex things I have ever seen in my whole life. I don't understand it. He was planning to get rid of his accounting firm in Seattle, which, he said, didn't seem to understand it either, and he certainly had no money to pay Cheryl. Cheryl gave her deposition next. Ted Runstein was now representing Brad, and she was frightened, jumpy as a rabbit, when he questioned her. She estimated that their basic living expenses, prior to Brad's moving out, were $10,000 a month. Early in their marriage, Brad had prepared the financial statements, and she had signed them. In 1982, Brad's figures showed total assets of $4,074,000 with outstanding liabilities of $1,200,000. This was during the time that the Houston project looked as if it was going to be a go. "I relied on what Brad said the values of these figures were," Cheryl said. "I had no reason at that point to believe that they were untrue."
"Okay," Runstein said. "Let's go to 1984 now. Mr. Cunningham, in early 1984, commenced sharing a residence with you again?" Yes, Cheryl said, he had been more or less back with them in 1984, and they had moved to Portland because Brad wanted to.
He felt he couldn't get employment in Seattle because of the bankruptcy and so many creditor banks in Seattle, so many enemies, as he put it. Cheryl had had to pass the Oregon bar and took a bar review course. They hired Marnie O'Connor as a babysitter. She didn't live in until about 2 weeks before she was fired, Cheryl testified.
When was she fired? Runstein asked.
Late August or early September.
Was this the young lady that Mr. Cunningham told you he was intimate with?
Yes.
Runstein went on to ask if she and Brad had discussed open marriage.
Brad had raised the subject numerous times, yes.
Brad had? You had not?
No.
Cheryl lost her composure. Brad was making faces and comments. She said she couldn't continue. Runstein admonished Brad to make no comments. My question, Runstein continued, is just prior to finding out about this young babysitter. Had you told him that you had had intercourse with someone during the marriage?
Absolutely not. And I hadn't, Cheryl said firmly.
She had never, ever gone along with Brad's enthusiasm for open marriage. Cheryl answered questions about the terrible scene on the first day Jess went to Bridal Mile School. It was still bitterly fresh in her mind. It had happened less than 2 weeks earlier. She trembled as she recalled that morning. Cheryl admitted that she had balled her hand into a fist and held it out, real hard, to stop Brad from pushing me backwards.
You were not angry at this time? I had been upset ever since he called me the night before. I was extremely angry at this man for causing this scene in front of my little boy. You bet I was.
For a moment, Cheryl showed her old fire. It was a long and tedious deposition, and Cheryl was strung so tightly she almost vibrated. Runstein asked her questions which seemed designed to trip her up, but Cheryl remained steady. She described the weekend when Brad moved back into the Gresham house as absolutely frightening.
Does the guest room have a lock?
Not to my knowledge. If it did, he put it in when he and Marnie screwed in it. I did notice one there as I was cleaning the room when I moved out. And I believe Brad put that on himself, as I said, probably for privacy with his babysitter.
Runstein's questions now touched on a volatile area. He asked if Cheryl felt Brad should see the children out of her presence. She tried to avoid a direct answer. She could feel the heat of Brad's rage. But Runstein kept needling her until she blurted,
"No, I don't think he should see them at all."
"Ever?" Runstein breathed.
"Considering what he's done lately, I don't think he shows himself to be mature enough to be a father figure for them."
She cited the Bridal Mile School spectacle.
"I think that speaks for itself."
"Okay. When was the first occasion when he struck the children, leaving welts and bruises?" Runstein was fishing. Cheryl hadn't mentioned her concern about that, but now she had to speak.
"You see," she began, knowing she was on treacherous ground, "I have a feeling I didn't know about that a lot of the times. The children got a lot of bumps and bruises that you think occur falling down. The one time we're talking about here occurred shortly after we moved from Seattle in 1985, when Michael was 3 years old."
"What did you do?" Runstein asked, when he had beaten the children so severely that they had welts and bruises.
"I confronted him with it. I told him that if he ever did that again, I would report him to the police, and he basically told me it was none of my business, and that if I wanted to have a few welts myself, he would give them to me."
Brad could not contain himself, and Cheryl turned to look at him, alarmed.
"I am not going to sit here and be intimidated by him. He scares me."
Cheryl was almost beyond fear now, but she plunged on. She described welts and bruises on Michael's thigh. "And did it ever happen again?" Runstein asked.
"He struck them a lot of times after that, but generally so as not to leave welts and bruises," Cheryl replied.
She said Brad had hit the boys on their bottoms and that
he generally confined his striking of the children to times when I wasn't around.
but the boys had told her. Brad was seething. Runstein showed Cheryl an affidavit she had signed 6 months earlier saying that Brad could see the children as often as he wanted. "I would agree to anything to get him out of the house, Mr. Runstein. Anything to get him physically out of my house. I figured the court would take care of him if he abused the children."
"Okay." Cheryl drew up every inch of her frail body and fixed her eye on Ted Runstein.
"If you are trying to imply I don't care about the well-being of my children, you are off base."
"You are not angry, are you?"
"Yeah, I'm real angry. You're upsetting me a great deal. It's been a long day."
Runstein suggested that they break for the day. The deposition adjourned at 4:04 p.m. The court reporter Michael King rode down in the elevator with Cheryl and saw that she was barely holding back tears. She had every reason to be upset. She had just broken all of Brad's rules. She had defied him. She had humiliated him in public. And most dangerous of all, she had officially accused him of child abuse. Brad viewed himself above all else as the perfect father. But Cheryl had held nothing back as she described him as an abusive father, a terrible father, a damaging father who was not fit to be with his sons. Never before had she made those accusations to his face, and now she had not only said it, she had said it for the record. Cheryl had covered for Brad for all the years of their sons' lives, sticking colored pins on maps, telling the little boys that their daddy loved them and would be home with them if he weren't working so hard, letting them believe that their daddy was perfect. Now she had spoken what she felt to be the truth. As a father, Brad was a monster. When Brad returned to his Madison Tower apartment that evening, Sarah Gordon saw the most anger I'd ever seen him exhibit. He was furious, pacing back and forth, repeating to Sarah over and over again that Cheryl had lied about everything. He was consumed with his rage over her deposition, the veins standing out on his forehead. He would talk of nothing else. Finally, he strode to his bedroom to call Cheryl. Sarah sat on the bed and listened.
"He was so angry that his speech was pressured," she recalled. "Brad was actually having trouble getting his words out."
"You lied at the deposition today," he growled at Cheryl through a throat tight with fury. "I'm going to get even, or you're going to pay."
Sarah sat frozen on Brad's bed, her mind recording this previously hidden facet of her lover's personality. She had never seen him out of control. She had never known him to make such a call before, and she was shocked at his venom. And yet, she was amazed to see how rapidly Brad's fury dissipated once he hung up the phone. It was as if he had blown out a pressure valve and everything was back to normal. He stopped pacing. He stopped repeating his epithets about Cheryl. Internally, something had changed. Perhaps he had made some decision. He had told Cheryl that he would have his revenge, and that seemed to make him feel better.
Chapter 31. From the 19th to the 21st of September, Sarah Gordon spent what was, at least for her, a fairly normal weekend. She had always worked harder and longer hours than any of her friends. That was a characteristic she shared with Cheryl. Both of these brilliant women had fought for an education, fought for a career usually enjoyed by men, and once they attained their toeholds, they had worked twice as hard as any man to succeed. During the summer of 1986, Sarah was totally in love with Brad, and she would have preferred to spend far more time with him than her practice allowed. But, in a way, she was working for both of them, for their future. She continued her usual 50 to 60 hours a week on call at Providence. It seemed even more important now that she and Brad had begun to talk about marriage. He had reluctantly told her that Cheryl was a profligate spender and that he had had to file for bankruptcy. Although he had had high expectations for the eventual windfall that would come from the suit Vincent and Elkins had filed on his behalf in Houston, The bottom was still falling out of the Houston economy, and he had been temporarily brought to his financial knees. How difficult it must have been, Sarah thought, for this proud man to tell her the details of his bankruptcy filing so he could save what little he had left. She admired him for his honesty, and she had no doubt that Brad would regain his financial footing soon. The man was a genius, and he had vision. He saw what the American public was going to need, and he set out to provide it way, way ahead of the pack. Brad hadn't lost everything, of course. He had his new job as an upper echelon executive with U.S. Bank, and he told Sarah that he had formed his own corporation, also called Spectrum, and that it was a going concern untouched by the bankruptcy. Although things were in the hush-hush stage, he said confidentially, his biotechnical division scientists had come up with a drug that would alleviate almost all the pain and symptoms of herpes. It was called Symptovir, and he said there was great excitement in the medical community about early test results. Sarah was impressed. As a physician, she knew that the drugs in current use were often ineffective. They were little more than placebos. With studies projecting that a third of the population of the United States would contract genital herpes sooner or later, any company with a better drug to treat the disease would make not millions, but billions. Sarah's talent wasn't business acumen, but she knew what Symptovir could mean. Brad would be back on the top of the heap, and she was working double shifts to help him get enough money together to rebuild his financial empire. Brad wanted her to mention Symptovir to her ex-husband, Dr. Jeff Morrow, but she was understandably hesitant to do that. He didn't really need her to pave the way for him anyway, but she was fully prepared to back Brad in his business and to help him take care of his children. From those confidences he had told her so haltingly and with such embarrassment, she realized that he had never had a woman who really loved him. Sarah cared deeply for him, and it seemed sad that a man with so much love to give had been so unlucky with the women in his life. Even his own mother had apparently been cold and selfish, although Brad spoke about her only vaguely, and Sarah didn't know whether she was alive or dead. But Brad had loved his father, and he had been desolate in July when Sanford Cunningham succumbed to his third heart attack, suffered while on a fishing trip. Sarah knew that Brad was still hurting from the loss. Sanford's pickup was parked in the basement of the Madison Tower, virtually unused now. On Friday, September 19th, 1986, Sarah rode along with Brad in his Chevy Suburban van when he drove to Cheryl's house to pick up Jess, Michael, and Philip. It was his weekend to have the boys. Sarah waited in the car, as always. She had yet to meet Cheryl, although she was extremely curious about the woman who was putting Brad through such an emotional ringer. And like any woman, she was curious to learn what she could about all the women who had come before her. A wild and gusty storm hit the Portland area that Friday night, and Sarah could barely see through the Suburban's windows as sheets of water shut out the world beyond the glass. She could see that Cheryl's brother Jim's car was still parked there. He was usually around when Brad picked up his sons. Squinting, Sarah watched Brad dash into the house to get the kids. Even without sound and at that distance, she could sense that Cheryl seemed frazzled as she moved quickly past the windows, getting the boys' coats, helping them push their arms into the sleeves, running back to get someone's special blankie. Brad's mouth moved constantly. Sarah wondered what he was saying to Cheryl. She felt like the outsider as she watched the two of them interact with each other in the warm light of Cheryl's home. They must have been in love once. They had three children together. Sarah felt a little shiver of jealousy, but she told herself not to be dumb. Brad cared only about his sons. He had said often enough how he detested Cheryl. If Sarah just thought rationally, she knew she had nothing at all to be jealous about. Cheryl looked attractive, but she also appeared to be a nervous wreck. Her movements were stilted and awkward. If everything Brad said about her was true, she had good reason to be nervous. Sarah could see now that Brad was carrying Philip as he herded Jess and Michael ahead of him through the rain. Cheryl stood silhouetted in the doorway, looking after them as if she were straining to catch a last glimpse of the boys, almost as if they were going away from her for more than a weekend. That was odd, Sarah thought, since Brad said that the kids drove Cheryl nuts and she could hardly wait to be rid of them so she could go out and have fun.
"What were you talking about in there?"
she asked Brad as they buckled the boys into car seats and seat belts. "Remember how I told you I'd never eat anything at home when we lived in Gresham?" Brad said. She nodded. Sarah had heard this before. Brad had told her that just before he moved out of the house he shared with Cheryl, things were so bad that he was actually afraid to eat anything she cooked. He had to have the boys taste it first because he suspected that Cheryl was trying to poison him. He told Sarah now that he had reminded Cheryl that he was fully aware that she and her mother Betty had been trying to destroy him. "I was telling her about how I listened in on those phone calls she had with her mother when I had to go over there to be sure the boys were okay," Brad said. "The calls where they talked about poisoning me to get rid of me, how they said that nobody would ever prosecute a case where a husband died like that." Sarah said nothing. It always struck her as bizarre that Brad could be so matter-of-fact about his estranged wife and her mother talking about poisoning his food, and she had to admit, at least to herself, that it was odd that he would risk the boys' safety by having them taste food he thought was poisoned. Maybe it was like Solomon and the two women who each claimed to be the mother of a baby. The real mother cried out as the sword descended to cut the baby in two. Cheryl, however lacking she was as a mother, would never have let her sons taste poison food, and Brad would know that. Sarah listened as Brad ranted on about Cheryl. She worried because he never censored his conversation in front of his sons. He always blurted out whatever was on his mind. The little boys were listening now, and Sarah didn't want Brad to get into the details again about some weird poison plot. Cheryl was, after all, their mother, and Brad could get a little histrionic. The boys appeared to love their mother a lot, no matter what. Sarah wasn't a mother, but she knew enough about psychology to know it wasn't good for kids to have to choose up sides between parents or to hear such accusations.
"What did you guys have for dinner?"
Sarah asked, changing the subject as she turned to face toward the second seat of the Suburban.
"Orange juice,"
Jess answered. Brad rolled his eyes. He said he was sure that Cheryl did that on purpose, filled the boys up with liquid so they would wet their beds in his apartment. Anything she could do to make life difficult for him, she would do. Back at the Madison Tower, Sarah and Brad tucked the boys into bed in the room that Brad kept just for them, Jess and Michael in their bunk beds and Philip in his crib. The storm eased, and everything was serene again. Sarah was on duty at Providence the next morning. She tiptoed out of the apartment and left them all sleeping. She had to be at the hospital by 6:30 a.m. The mass of Portland is divided in two by the Willamette River, and the Madison Tower is in the western part, while Providence Hospital is in the eastern section. Even so, Sarah had only about 7 miles to drive, crossing the river via the Morrison Bridge. She drove her Toyota Cressida. It was white, and she had treated herself to the deluxe leather interior. Her commute was a quick trip along the rain-scrubbed, empty streets of an early weekend morning Portland. Sarah knew Brad planned to take the boys to Jess's first soccer game that day. All of them, with the possible exception of Philip, who was too young to understand, were excited about it. Jess was going to play for the Bridal Mile Buddies. Then Brad was going to take the boys to Dunkin' Donuts after the game. Sarah hoped they all had a fun day. As it turned out, it wasn't a fun day, at least not for Brad. When Sarah got home Saturday evening, she found him fuming.
He told her that Cheryl had broken the custody rules again. This was supposed to be his weekend, and Cheryl knew that, but she had shown up brazenly at Jess's soccer game, deliberately horning in on his time with the boys. It had ruined the game for Brad. He had to look at Cheryl sitting there in the bleachers as if she had every right to be there. One of Cheryl's Gamma Phi Beta sorority sisters from the University of Washington, Nancy Davis, had a son on the Bridal Mile Buddies, too, and her husband was the boys' coach, so Cheryl had sat there with Nancy. Brad told Sarah that he had picked up Philip and Michael and walked to the other side of the field to avoid her. It had gotten to the point where Brad and Cheryl seemed to be fighting over even the most minute details of custody, and, to Sarah at least, it seemed such a waste of emotion. But then she had never had a child, and she didn't like to judge Brad's reactions. They tucked the boys in, then Brad and Sarah went to bed, but her beeper sounded at 2:30 on Sunday morning, and she was called back to Providence Hospital to administer anesthesia for emergency surgery. After the patient was stable and out from under the anesthesia, she went back to Brad's apartment and caught a few hours' sleep. Exhausted, she still forced herself to get up so she could have breakfast with Brad and the boys. She was supposed to meet a girlfriend for brunch, but she was too tired. She called and canceled. Brad could see how tired Sarah was, so he thoughtfully took the boys out to play in the park after breakfast. Grateful, she crawled back into bed until 1 and was back on duty at the hospital at 3 p.m. She had scarcely seen Jess, Michael, and Philip all weekend, so she suggested that they all have supper with her that Sunday evening. The American Dream Pizza Company was kitty-corner from one wing of Providence, and the boys loved pizza. At 5 p.m., Sarah left the medicinal-smelling hospital corridors and walked to the restaurant, enjoying the sunny September afternoon. Brad was always on time. That was just one of the many things Sarah liked about him. If he said he would be someplace, she could count on him. She thought he looked handsome as he strode toward her with his sons, but then Brad always looked handsome to Sarah. Later she remembered he was wearing a burgundy golf shirt, casual slacks, and a brown leather jacket. She couldn't recall if he was wearing boots or tennis shoes. At the time, it didn't matter. They had a leisurely meal, enjoying each other's company and the beautiful Sunday evening. Grinning devilishly, Brad urged the boys to drink more and more Pepsi. Cheryl had delivered them to him with their bladders full of orange juice. Now he would return the favor and take them home full of soda pop. Toward the end of their meal, Brad told Sarah that something was wrong with his Suburban. It was missing and stalling, and he suspected he had probably gotten a tank of dirty gas that was plugging his gas line. He asked the boys to demonstrate the sound his van made, and they all laughed when Jess and Michael obliged by snorting and hiccuping. "Could I borrow your car to take the kids back to Cheryl?" Brad asked. Sarah nodded. She wouldn't be needing her Toyota Cressida that evening anyway. She would be either in the doctor's lounge, in the on-call room, or in surgery. Brad drove his Suburban over from the pizza place and parked it next to Sarah's car in the doctor's lot. Sarah walked back with the boys, reluctant to leave the clean air and dappled sunlight of that lovely evening. Brad was pouring some kind of gas additive into the tank of his van when they caught up with him. "It needs to sink in the tank for a while," he said. "It'll work better that way." Sarah knew absolutely nothing about the inner workings of a car. She didn't know that a gas additive doesn't even start to work until the vehicle is actually driven and the additive circulates through the adulterated gas lines. She gave Brad her key ring. He took off her car key and handed back her other keys and the keys to his Suburban, although neither one of them expected she would need them. If Brad was nervous about driving the Suburban because the engine was missing, she certainly wasn't about to venture out in it. Anyway, Brad promised he would be back to visit with her in the doctor's lounge within the hour. It was about 7:10 when Brad and the boys were ready to go. As usual, things were a little hectic. Brad suddenly remembered that he had left Jess's special blankie back at his apartment.
"Maybe I'll call Cheryl and have her pick up the boys for a change," he said. "I can hand her the blanket then."
As far as Sarah knew, Cheryl had never before picked up her sons at the Madison Tower, nor had she delivered them there. She wondered if Cheryl would even agree to that. She seemed to give Brad such a hard time about everything. One thing Sarah did know. There was no way that Brad was going to get to Cheryl's house in the West Slope area by 7, not from Providence Hospital. He still had to go through downtown Portland and then swing west onto Route 26, the Sunset Highway. Brad gave Sarah a quick peck on the cheek and again promised he would be back to spend the evening with her until about 9. Brent had been gone all weekend on a scuba diving trip to Hood Canal and was due home after that. Brad wanted to be there when he got back. When Brad and the boys drove off, Sarah waved goodbye and headed back to the doctor's lounge. Her schedule demanded that she remain on trauma call all night. The hospital provided a suite not unlike a nice hotel suite for physicians who were on call overnight. She would begin her regular operation schedule first thing Monday morning. It was possible that she would be working almost around the clock. If she was lucky, she would get a good night's sleep. At about 7:30, she was watching television in the lounge when the hospital operator paged her and she picked up the phone. It was Brad.
"I called Cheryl," he said. "She's going to pick up the boys. I still should be over there before 8.
Sarah was relieved. They chatted for about 5 minutes, and then she turned her attention back to the television. She expected to look up at any moment and see Brad coming through the door of the lounge. He had been there often enough to know exactly where to find her. But Brad didn't appear. If she was expecting anyone else, Sarah wouldn't have been concerned, but Brad was such a punctual man. She called his apartment shortly before 8 and was surprised to hear the phone ring 5, 6, 10 times. His answering machine always came on by the 4th ring, but this time the phone just rang endlessly. At 8:30, she dialed Brad's number again, and again the phone rang emptily. Until that night, Sarah had never known Brad to leave his apartment without making sure the answering machine was on. With his business interests, with his concern about the boys, with his graciousness in always being available to her, he just automatically left it on. Sarah was disappointed and a little irritated. If Brent was due home at 9, Brad wouldn't be able to come and spend any time at all with her. Their times alone together were precious because they were so infrequent, and now they had lost another evening. Sarah kept glancing at the clock. It was getting dark outside, and now she was not only annoyed, she was getting worried. There was such enmity between Brad and Cheryl. Sarah had seen Brad enraged, frustrated almost to the point of tears only 5 days ago. She felt a presentiment of doom. Maybe she was superstitious. Just when everything was as close to perfect in her own personal life as she had ever imagined it might be, she didn't want to lose the man she loved.
"I remembered what Brad had said about Cheryl trying to poison him," Sarah would recall. "I didn't take it seriously, but..."
Maybe Brad had had an accident. He had been in such a tearing hurry when he left. And those darling little boys wouldn't be as safe in her sedan as in the big suburban. Every time she heard a siren approach the hospital, Sarah flinched. She didn't just love Brad. She loved Jess, Michael, and Philip, too. It was so out of character for Cheryl to go to Brad's apartment to pick up the boys. Why would she agree to do that tonight? Sarah wondered. And if she had agreed, why wouldn't Brad be there? The night no longer looked lovely. It looked dark and empty outside the hospital window. Her work in the trauma unit reminded her every day that people someone loved often never went home again, and most of them had parted saying, "I'll see you."
Just before 9, Sarah tried Brad's number again. This time, to her great relief, he answered.
"Where have you been?" she asked angrily.
Brad sounded out of breath and a little excited when he spoke.
"We've been down waiting for Cheryl," he said.
"For an hour and a half?"
"Yes," he said, and then elaborated. He told Sarah that he had called Cheryl at 7:30 and asked her as nicely as he could if she would come and pick up the boys, but it had been clear to him, he said, that she had not been alone.
"I heard someone in the background. She probably just went out partying."
Sarah slammed down the phone. She wasn't sure if she was mad at Brad or at Cheryl, but she felt guilty and foolish almost immediately. From everything Brad had told her about Cheryl, she might very well have left him waiting that long. Contrite, she called Brad back.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm calmed down now. I was just worried that you were either out killing Cheryl or that she was killing you. This is the first time since I've known you that you weren't where you told me you would be."
Brad sounded upset, too, as he accepted her apology.
"What were you telling me about hearing somebody at Cheryl's house?" Sarah asked.
"I just heard some guy. The second time I called, she wasn't home. She probably just decided to go out and party."
"Well, where have you been, Brad?"
"Like I said, waiting for Cheryl downstairs. She never showed."
They agreed it was too late for Brad to drive over to the hospital. Besides, Brent wasn't home yet, and there wasn't anybody for Brad to leave the boys with. Sarah told him she was going to go to bed, and he said he would tuck the boys in at his apartment. Sarah was disappointed, but she was no longer angry at Brad. It was hard for her to stay mad at him for very long. She loved him too much.
Chapter 32 Cheryl's last weekend was bittersweet. She had gone to Jess's soccer game, even though Brad had told her that on his Saturdays she was not allowed to go to the games or to speak to the boys or even to act as if she knew her own sons. She had called her mother either on Friday night after Brad picked the boys up or on Saturday morning.
"Cheryl wanted to go to Jess's game," Betty would recall, "but she didn't want to make it bad for them."
Betty and Marv Trosseth were all too aware of the terrible strain Cheryl had been under for most of that year. They lived in Longview, and so did her sisters Julia and Susan and her former stepfather, Bob McNanny. They all loved her, but none of them could do much to help except listen. Betty and Cheryl had grown extremely close, and they talked constantly by phone.
"The main issue, of course," Betty would say later, "was the custody of the children. At first she was afraid she wouldn't get them. I told her that was ridiculous. Cheryl said, 'He will lie in court. He will kill me to get them.' I tried to talk her out of shared custody. I really preached. He wasn't fit to have them."
Betty remembered that Cheryl had looked at her once and said with complete resignation,
"I'll have to put up with him. For the rest of my life, I'll have to deal with Brad."
Cheryl had felt cautiously confident after Dr. Sardo decided that she was the primary parent. Right up to the last week, she believed she would have custody, although she knew it wasn't going to be easy. She told her mother that she and Brad had both given depositions on